Welcome to Franchise Fan Guys. This is our fourth episode on the Blade Runner franchise. I'm Tom Breifogel, joined with Andy Schmidt and Skid Marr. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
Hey, I'm Andy Schmidt, and in case you haven't listened to the previous episodes, I like Blade Runner.
Hey, I'm Skid Marr. I like Blade Runner too. I was asleep earlier. I was dreaming of electric sheep, and that's from Blade Runner.
Franchise Fan Guys. Have either of you read the book?
I read it in high school. Yeah, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. I did read it in high school. I wrote a, this is kind of funny. So in high school, I had this English teacher who kept sort of like putting out that like, you shouldn't watch movies if there's a book based on it. You should read the book because the book is always better. That was like just like a recurring theme for her. So I was like, oh, well, I'll write this paper on books that then get turned into movies, and you know, that'll be great. She'll love that. So I did two Philip K. Dick stories, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which was turned into Blade Runner, the short story, We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, which was turned into the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Total Recall. Yeah. And I read, I can't even think of the title of it now. By Roderick Thorpe, what's the title? Which was turned into Die Hard.
Okay.
And it's a sequel. That is a sequel to a previous book. And I can't think of it. I just can't think of the title right now. But so I read those three, the two novels and one short story, and then, you know, and then analyzed them, comparing them to the films. And in all three cases, I wound up concluding that the films were actually superior in many ways to the source material, which is probably not fair to do with the Total Recall, We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, because there's a conceptual idea, and like that's where the similarities end. But I just really enjoy that movie. And Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is really cool. It's very, very different from Blade Runner. Like it's ideas are there. Deckard's a character, you know, that kind of thing. And so I turned in this paper, and the conclusion was, these films are actually better than the source material. That was the conclusion I drew, and I got a D on it. And she had a rule that you could rewrite it, that you could rewrite something and turn it in, and you could improve your grade. So literally, all I did was change the last. Changed the conclusion part of this 6-page paper so that the books were better. That was the only thing I changed, and turned it in, and I got an A.
Brainwashing.
I did. I did not change any of the evidence, and all of the evidence clearly leads to the films being better. And then I just was like, but in conclusion, the books are better. And then that was it. Wow. That was all it took.
Great. Yeah. That's good teaching.
Playing the game. I learned how to play the game. That's important.
Yeah, that is important. Reading the professor is as important as reading the material that you're assigned. I have not read When Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, but my old friend Ed Einhorn adapted that book as a play, and I saw that play. So I have seen how completely different the original source material is from the film. And I don't remember a whole lot, but I remember thinking, wow, this is a completely different thing.
And I did read I think I said that this in the other episode, that I did read, you know, back in the day, and I don't remember it because I don't remember it very well. I didn't really care for it, but the novels that Jeter wrote, and then and actually just the other night I read the 12 issues of Blade Runner 2019, the fairly recent comic book put out by Titan, which is co-written by Michael Green, who was one of the screenwriters of 2049, the comic book writer Mike Johnson, who I got to know because I was the editor on Star Trek for a while, Star Trek comics, when he was writing some of those. And it was pretty interesting. I mean, we can talk about some. I mean, we're talking about the future of the franchise, so we can talk about some of those things too.
Awesome.
All of that just reminded me of a paper I wrote in high school that I haven't thought about in 20 years, where I wrote the importance of swear words in movies, and I wrote about Pulp Fiction. And the teacher was very upset when I said I was going to write about it. And she said, you're not allowed to write about that. And then I still did it, but I got an A. And then she was like, you were right. You had some valid points.
Wow.
But she was a cool teacher.
Oh, cool. I'd love to read that paper.
Yeah, wherever that is, if it exists.
I wrote a paper, and I was taking a Tolkien class in, I think, 1995. And I wrote a paper about, if there was ever a movie of Lord of the Rings, how would I approach it and who would I cast in it? That's a fun little relic. I still have that.
Who were you going to cast as Frodo?
Oh, Frodo, I can't remember. The only one I remember is that I cast Gandalf as either me, assuming I'd be old enough to be able to play it by the time they made a movie of it, or Sean Connery, who they initially approached to play Gandalf, and he turned them down. So,
wow.
Because he wanted to make League of Extraordinary Gentlemen instead.
Yeah, that's the thing. He made League of Extraordinary Gentlemen because they came to him and they're just like, play this wizard. And he's just like, I don't understand that. And then they're like, okay. And they make it with somebody else and it becomes this huge hit. So the next project that came along that he didn't understand, he took it thinking that it would be a huge hit. And it was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
True story.
So the Blade Runner franchise has continued to move forward with an animated series and comic books with more planned. But let's say you're in charge of how to turn Blade Runner into a film series. Where would you go from here? Andy?
Well, that's tough. As Skid pointed out in our last episode, neither one of them were financially successful. So, you know, like really looking at it if I'm really trying to put myself in the role of like, you know, I'm working at a studio or whatever, and like we're doing a Blade Runner 3 and it's my job to figure out how to do it so that it's still Blade Runner and it makes money. That's tough. That's really, really tough. But I think with any of this, where you have to start is, you know, kind of going, what is it that people who are fans of this love about it? Because obviously there are people like us out there that do love it. But also, how do you expand beyond that audience? Which I think Blade Runner 2049 really attempted to do. Blade Runner 2049 is not as slow paced. It's not a super fast paced movie. There's a little bit more action in it. There's I think they were really trying to make something that had a little wider appeal, but while also not losing what people love about Blade Runner. And I think it did everything that it set out to do, except bring in a wider, newer audience. Although I still would argue that, you know, it was well received in a way that the original was not particularly well received even at the time. I think we talked about how like Blade Runner has this really great like Rotten Tomatoes score. And it's like those were written years later. Like at the time it was there were good reviews, but there were also a lot of really negative reviews.
Yeah, this was well received. And honestly, if it weren't as expensive to make, if the budget was, well, that'd be a lot less than it was, and it would be a different movie as a result. But the reason that it's just that won't justify a sequel probably is because it was so expensive. Everything, yeah, like people liked it, just didn't get a huge audience. It needed a huge audience. It didn't get it.
Yeah, and so they've gone into animation and they've gone into comic books, and I think there are novels planned. Like they are still moving forward with the franchise, but those are less expensive media to produce. And which, like, I get that, because if you can stay true from a story perspective and to a character perspective and make more Blade Runner things that appeal to that fan base, having that smaller fan base can work on less expensive products if they show up for it. Like I said, like I've read the Blade Runner 2019 comics and they're good. And clearly Titan, you know, put some money behind it. One of the coolest things about them actually is that they took Blade Runner concept art from Sid Mead that he had in his collection and used a lot of it for covers, which is super cool.
Oh, that's cool.
They've done more. There's a sequel to Blade Runner 2019 called Blade Runner 2029, so set a decade later, that I've not read. And there's another one called Blade Runner Origins, which I think it's about the first replicants, but I haven't read that one yet either. And I watched the first episode of Black Lotus and didn't get into it, the animated series. Have either of you seen that?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I've only seen the first episode. I'll probably watch the rest of it at some point, but these movies are long, and I watched Blade Runner 5 times for this, so that was all of my free time. I totally get the thinking of that. Like if you realize, like, our audience, in order to stay true to the thing, our audience is unlikely to expand quickly. Like, it could expand slowly, like by word of mouth. We could create things that are true to it, that are less expensive, that could be profitable on their own. I think that's a very valid approach. I'm not speaking to the success of the products that they've actually created or the animated show that they've created, but that approach makes a lot of sense to me. And the people in charge of Blade Runner clearly want it to be a franchise. The other thing that those sort of, we'll call them sort of ancillary, just anything that's not a film, is it can help you build the universe out, can build the world out. You're introducing new characters, and you can, you can set one in Moscow, Blade Runner's Moscow in 20 whatever. So I think that approach is valid, but how to approach a third film, because after 2049, if you just cut the budget in half, well, now I'm going to go to this, as a fan, I'm going to go to this Blade Runner 3, whatever it's called, and, like, it's not going to be, you're not going to be able to do all those visual effects and all those cool shots and all that sort of stuff. So you're going to have to find a way to limit the scope of Blade Runner, limit the world of Blade Runner, because that's probably the most expensive stuff, and make it, just kind of make this story without the world building. But the world building is so important to Blade Runner that I'm not sure how you do that. One approach, because there was another franchise that sort of tackled a similar sort of thing, and that was Judge Dredd. So when they made the most recent Judge Dredd movie, which is, Judge Dredd, the science fiction thing, it's set in Mega City 1, which is kind of like Los Angeles from Blade Runner, but on steroids. And what they did was they were like, well, we can't have Dredd running all over the city. Like, that'll be way too expensive. And so they did a story that confined it to one building. This building is cut off. So there's a couple of shots of the city, there's a, scene that sort of sets up the world, and then they go into this building, and then everything takes place in this building, which severely limits the budget. And so it walks that line of, like, well, we did some world building, we established the world that it's in, but then the whole story takes place here. And you could do something similar like that with Blade Runner. Like, maybe the story goes out of the city, so you've got a little bit in the city to establish that, to get, fans comfortable. But, if they're chasing a replicant or whatever, the chase goes out of the city and goes into the, I was going to say wilderness, but I don't know that there really is wilderness, because they're constantly talking about how nobody's seen something that's alive. But go somewhere else where you can, goes to a desert where the budget can be a lot lower and that sort of thing. But, those are the things that I would if I'm actually in that job and I'm looking at budgets, those are the things I have to think about. And then you go, okay, well, these are our obstacles, right? And then you go, okay, what can I do? What can we do that naturally uses the things that we can do or would naturally take us out of the city? So you find a story reason to take you out of the city if that's something you have to do, or you find a, a character driven reason to move the locations or whatever. But I'm not really even getting into a storyline. I don't have any idea what that storyline would be, but that is how I think you would have to be approaching it, is how can I deliver something that's authentically Blade Runner, which is hard enough as is. But
yeah, it's a miracle that we got it at all.
Right. Yeah, I think of all, every time we've asked this question, I think this is the hardest one, because that world building is built into Blade Runner and is synonymous with Blade Runner in a way that it really isn't in really any other franchise I can think of, which isn't to say that world building isn't very important to other franchises, but Like, I mean, you think of Blade Runner and you think of the spinners, you think of the city, you think of the sort of gun looking buildings and all that kind of stuff. You know, even his apartment is so distinct. You know, both of their apartments, Kay and Deckard, are so distinct that, but you know, a lot of that can be done on a smaller budget. But I think that's how, like, from a, you know, if I really am in that role of like, I'm the producer, I'm the IP, and we've got to lower the budget on this thing, but still deliver. That's where that process is going to have to start. And then once you understand your parameters, then you can get into, okay, what story is Blade Runner authentically and can fit within these parameters? That's a big ask, because one of the biggest asks I've seen in sequels is doing a sequel to Blade Runner, where he essentially had an unlimited budget, like $150 million is a lot. And now you'd be trying to do the same thing again, but with less of a budget. Like, and I don't, yeah. I mean, I think the likelihood of it working well is low, which is not to say it can't be done. I'm sure it can be done, but yeah, that's the approach I would have to, I think you, that any studio or whatever, or, you know, producer would have to be taking.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, because we're sort of pondering how to fix something that from our perspective is not broken. Like, we love this as it is. We love 2049. Well, all of us except Tom. Both of us. So it is funny to like try to think of ways to make other people like it, but may make us like it less. I don't think we've done that before. That seems new.
That is new.
You know,
it's like you might be all these right. Other things, you might be right. Like, in order to make it make money, you might have to make something that the fans of Blade Runner, you probably would have to make something the fans of Blade Runner would like less.
Yeah, like real fans would very likely like whatever we came up with less than 2049. Not necessarily, but.
Yeah, as a counter argument, the themes of Blade Runner, the ideas of Blade Runner don't necessarily have to be expensive.
No, not at all. I think they did, like the shorts did a pretty good job on obviously much more limited budgets. Telling a couple of shorter stories in that world for cheaper. You know, I think it can be done. I think one of the things, well, there are two things. One is, I think you have to make a shorter movie, probably.
Probably.
I think that was one of the main complaints from more casual viewers, is that it was too long. It never felt long to me. I did not feel like it felt long. I think that movie could have been twice as long and I at the same pace, and I would have been fine with it. I would have loved it.
I'm always sad when it's over. Like, I want more.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it's like, yeah, I don't know. I never get bored. There is one shot that I think you could justify tightening a little bit. The sequence where, oh man, and I love this part where he goes to visit the orphanage out in the Junker Wastes by San Diego, where you used to live, Andy.
That's pretty much what it was like.
Right. You remember. But I love that whole Dickensian kind of thing. That's one of my favorite, like another one of my favorite parts of the movie. But where he sees the horse in the ashtray and reminds him, it's like, maybe I should go look for this thing. And like that shot of him walking towards the furnace, I think that's like 4 minutes long. And I think it's justified, but you know, that's one spot where I think, you know, maybe you could trim that up a little bit and you wouldn't lose much. Doing that, but it's hard to say, like taking that approach, that hatchet to the rest of the movie, like, I don't think you can do it. So one other thing that I would say is probably you need more action, which is something that Blade Runner has never really had a lot of. But the action, the little bit of action that we get in this movie is fucking great. I love the fight scene with Sapper. I love that scene in the beginning where he's slamming him into the wall, like crashes through it. And that's sort of the sort of contrast in their body shapes and their fighting styles with his brutality and Kay's efficiency. That's so great. But then, you know, and I love when Wallace's goons and Love are coming into Vegas to capture him, and Decker goes through the door and he locks it, and then Kay just comes smashing through the wall. I love those moments where you're reminded that the replicants are more than human. Like, I love those things. And yeah, and just the futile, like when Kay is defending himself from the scavengers when his spinner car gets shot down in the Junker Wastes. All this stuff, it's great. But I wonder how much of the impact of it is because there is so little of it. Like, I love it, but is it because there's only a few moments and it really stands out? It feels really special. If you put a bunch more of it in the movie, how would that affect things? I think Denis Villeneuve, like, I think he directs action very well. Even in most of his movies, there really isn't very much. Like, he has a great sense for it. So if he were to do another movie like that, like, I think you could do something that worked really well on that level. But I mean, yeah, I guess I think that those would be the two things I think you would need if you were going to try to make something with more mass market appeal.
Right, and I think the thing with the action, like, and you know, this is kind of a callback to older episodes of our podcast, but like, I think the thing with the action is, you can have more action as long as you don't stop telling the story and stop developing the characters. So, like, you know, again, and that's what we talked about with Terminator 2. That's what we have talked about with Aliens, was the two James Cameron movies that have like an hour of action that end on it, but it never feels gratuitous because there's so much character work still going on. And that's true of the original Blade Runner. Like, I mean, that's essentially an action scene. I mean, maybe it's more of a suspense sequence at the end, from when he goes into J.F. Sebastian's home. I mean, it's suspense, it's kind of thriller, but it's also action, right? He gets in the fight with Pris. That's an action sequence. When Roy Batty shows up, like, that's all, I mean, you could argue it's all an action sequence, but there's all the character work that is going on through it. And you could have more, you know, you could fire more shots, or you could have more punches or being hit. I love when he gets hit by the metal pipe.
That hurt.
Yeah. So, but like, good. If you keep the character moments going, then you can have a more extended action without it feeling gratuitous or getting tedious. Tom, any thoughts from you? Because you usually have the
answer. Tom, let's get the correct answer.
Let's get the correct answer.
Okay, well, my idea is, I've not read any of the comic books or seen anything animated, so they could contradict, but have they done a Blade Runner 1999 yet?
I don't
not
think
that
so.
I'm aware of. No.
Okay, because I think that could be cool to see Tyrell and see the Nexus 1s or Nexus 2s and then learn, and it's based in 1999, so it would look... It could even be 89, but I don't know if that would work with Tyrell's age. Maybe it would work. With 99, Decker would be 20 years old.
I think 89, yeah. I think with Tyrell's age, yeah. You could have a young Tyrell in 89 for
sure. Okay, then yeah, then maybe 89. If you did 89, then Decker is either not in it or he's 10 years old. And if he's 10 years old, then that totally lets you know he's not a replicant. But if it's 99, he could be 20 and maybe waking up from a coma. So then you could be like, maybe he is a replicant who lives long. I don't know. Or maybe
and that's
just
your opening
no
shot
Decker.
Is on his eyeball as he's waking up from the coma.
Totally. So
there's another unknown eyeball in 2049. There's that blue eye. No idea whose eye that's supposed to be. But go ahead.
Is that Anna Staline? Isn't it Anna Staline's? That's what I thought.
I don't know.
It probably is. Yeah. I'm just going to have to go watch it again.
I just assumed.
Too bad.
Yeah, I guess got to watch it again. That was what I always assumed. I don't know, but yeah.
But it could be cool if we saw that replicants were initially made to manipulate people or to get information from people, but they sometimes fail and they sometimes just like people just like think this person just dropped dead. I think that could be interesting. Or like replicants really kind of like the movie They Live. I really love that movie. Like the replicants start living around us, and then they know more than us, but they do have the limited lifespan, but they, yeah, run away and just try to live a normal life for 4 years. So like someone could be married to a replicant and not even know what a replicant is, and they just fall over dead at like 28 years old or something. Yeah, so I don't know what the story would be, but I would really like that for a prequel.
Actually, yeah, I like that. That sort of early stages of replicants and them sort of testing out what they can use them for.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like, that's a cool idea. That's, I like that a lot.
Yeah, he always has the right answer.
He does. It's so uncanny.
And it's low budget. Time.
It is. Yeah. Yes. It's Tom's superpower.
It is lower budget. God, he nails it every time. full disclosure, years ago, I actually tried to get the rights to do Blade Runner comics when I was at IDW Publishing.
I failed.
But I had put together a proposal, and you know, because 2049 hadn't come out yet, I'm not even sure if it had been announced, but you know, this is just a passion project that I'd want to do. And I didn't want to like pitch like, we're going to do Blade Runner 2, right? Like what I wanted to pitch was, we're going to do stories that are in and around Blade Runner, the original. And so like the pitch was like, we do a story about Holden. We do a story about, you know, J.F. Sebastian and, you know, kind of do like just build out Blade Runner further and hopefully add more layers to it with the comics, but not try and like move the whole franchise forward, because usually what happens if you try to pitch that to them, they're like, yeah, we're going to do that. That's for us to do. You need to stay in your lane. Like that's the response. So like, but like building out that, doing the story of them, of the replicants in the first one, like escaping from off world and getting the ship and all that stuff, like filling in all those gaps, but not just to fill them in, but to add layers to who they are and what their experiences are. And there were certain things, there were certain touch points that like I didn't want to do. Like I didn't want to see attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. Like, I don't think you should see that. I don't think you should visualize that. You know, there are certain things that felt like, you know, and so, you know, one of the things that I had, you know, I had sort of thought about with that was like Roy Batty would leave at one point potentially and be changed when he returns after experiencing that. But we wouldn't actually see that, you know, Tannhauser Gate or whatever. Anyway, that was another approach, but obviously not a film approach. But the prequel idea, I think, is interesting because it does some of the same sorts of things. You could flesh out Tyrell, and you could paint Tyrell in a different light, doing what I think 2049 does well, which is sort of reframing and expanding on who some of these characters are. And also, like, yeah, I mean, I agree. Like, seeing sort of what were they used for. Like what was the original purpose? Like how do you pitch that? So I'm gonna make people. I'm gonna make a bunch of fake people.
Because there's probably a bunch of different applications that they would just like, let's try this out. There are probably hundreds of different applications, like espionage, like Tom says, like a ton of different stuff before they settled on, you know, the kind of the roles that they ended up filling.
Right. Yeah, because those are roles where you have to be a person, right? Like espionage to spy or whatever, or the pleasure models, right? Like, I mean, then you actually have to create a human. Most other tasks don't have to be done by a human. Like if you're going to go mine coal, why would you go to the effort to build something that replicates a human perfectly? Why not just go make a coal mining machine?
Right. Yeah. Which is kind of like when Love is selling the models to her client in 2049, she's like, well, you just need them. I think it is mining. They're just like, you just need them for physical labor. I wouldn't bother giving them too many human characteristics, you know, like that kind of idea.
Yeah. And then she's like, but I'd throw in some pleasure models for you.
Yeah. I'll throw in some pleasure models. Yeah.
You want to keep your human workforce happy.
But that's the thing too. I'm not sure if she's saying you need pleasure models for the people that you have working for your company, or if you need them for the mining replicants to keep them happy. I'm not completely sure. But that is something, like Andy, you struck on something that is really important, which is you really can't show off-world. And I think stay true to kind of what Blade Runner has been. That's one of that kind of restraint, like not seeing it, that kind of existing in this sort of mythical kind of area. I think it's really important to what Blade Runner is. And I appreciate that, like this film, 2049, like you don't see it. And that's one of the things that I love is like Wallace says, we have ways of making you speak off world. And just imagining what that could possibly mean. When this guy who has all this power on Earth, what could he possibly have that's more effective at making somebody talk outside of the Earth, outside of Earth's orbit? Like I shudder to think of like what that could imply. But yeah, that's something that like it really does have to take place on this planet that has been ruined, and these people are stuck here. And there are people, like we think, living a better life out there, but like you're stuck in this in hell with these people.
Well, that's it for this episode of Franchise Fan Guys. If you're a Patreon subscriber, stick around where we will talk yet again about the new Lord of the Rings series on Amazon.
Oh boy. Oh boy.
Thanks for listening to Franchise Fan Guys. Blade Runner, episode 4 of 4. Please write a review and give a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts. Intro music by Tom Breifogel and John Harvey. To connect, visit franchisefanguys.com, at franchisefanguys on Instagram, and at guysfranchise on Twitter. Franchise Fan Guys.